alfalfa fields and cornfields where we live.
Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. For members, the little tchotchkes at your seats are for the second bill on the agenda. First on the agenda is Senate File 267. Senator Rest.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 267 is a proposal that this committee has seen before dealing with plastic bag recycling, and what it does is to create a plastic bag recycling program. The first section of it in Subdivision 1 simply sets out the definitions, and in an author's amendment, there's a further refinement of that definition to apply only to the seven-county metropolitan area and cities of the first class outside of the metropolitan area, and then further to the amendment would direct the study, the commissioner of the PCA to study and recommend ways to to find out if there are ways to increase recycling in greater Minnesota. Just as an aside, when we were at Moorhead in the tax committee meetings that we were having and the forums that we were having this past week, one of the testifiers in Moorhead got up and referred to greater outstate Minnesota, just in case we didn't get it, I think. Anyway, I thought that was very touching. Greater outstate Minnesota.
Senator Rest, would you like to adopt the author's amendment?
Mr. Chairman, if you'd be so kind.
Senator Fredrickson will move the A1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Again, the bill sets up a plastic bag recycling bill. This proposal has been something that has been a passion and received strong advocacy from Senator Anderson. And at the time that I introduced the bill, it had been my understanding that she was not going to pursue it this year. But I thought, particularly having heard from one of my constituents who supports this very strongly, that it was important to bring it before the legislature, even if this year in particular, Senator Anderson had not made a final decision on the bill. But I certainly support her and her leadership in this area, and this bill is in no way an attempt to undermine that, and she has become a co-author on the bill. So paragraph A requires operators to establish an in-store recycling program with directives as to the language on the outside face of the bags, placing bins for collections of the bags in their establishments, et cetera, and to collect, transport, and recycle bags and other film plastic return to the store consistent with the program requirements. The next three paragraphs just sets out the program requirements, and then subdivision 3 details the responsibility of manufacturers. In the second section, there is a transition period. Once again, I'm sure that the issues are familiar to this committee, but I would like to invite my constituent, Mr. Anderson, to come and testify on the bill and the strong action that he and his family take on a regular basis to reduce litter and to clean up the riverbanks of two of Minnesota's rivers.
Very good. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Mike Anderson. I live in Crystal, Minnesota.
Proceed.
The reason that I support this this bill and the essence of what this bill seeks to accomplish is because my wife and I have been involved in a river cleanup program or effort. It's not really so much an organized program as it is just an effort where we have participated in the Minnesota DNR's Adopt a River program and spent a considerable amount of time on the Mississippi and the North Metro, the North Half of the Metro Mississippi River, and also two stretches of the St. Croix River. And we spend a lot of time on the weekends.
Speak up a little.
Sure. We spend a lot of time cleaning up rivers. We go out in kayaks and canoes, and we pick up junk, which is not a terribly romantic weekend activity, but it's something that we enjoy because we can look behind us and see something a little bit better than what we set out to spend time with. We focus on a couple of different areas. Number one is items that have been intentionally just dumped, whether that's tires or small appliances or things like that, things that people have not taken the time to dispose of properly. They've just seen fit to use the river as kind of a waste bin, if you will. So that's one area of focus. Another area of focus that has been a little bit more pervasive and difficult to get our hands around is floatables, things that we'll refer to as, you know, might be a plastic fountain cup, beverage cups from a convenience store or a fast food restaurant. It might be plastic water bottles or soft drink bottles or whatever. But among those floatables is plastic bags. And it just seems to us one of the things we've done over the winter when we can't be on the water, we've been trying to learn a little bit about how all of this junk finds its way into the riverways. And one thing we've noticed is that just beneath almost any spillway where a storm sewer enters the river or a small tributary, like Shingle Creek or any of the small rivers you might be familiar with here in the Twin Cities, that immediately downstream there's a pretty good oversized debris field of floatables in that part of the river. When I see this bill and what it attempts to do, what it aspires to accomplish, the most important thing that that I think happens is that people become more aware of what's out there in the way of junk, and also more aware that a solution is within their grasp and that they can be part of the solution as opposed to being part of the problem. One of the things that we notice a lot of in the riverways when we're out there cleaning is tires, just as an example. And I know that's not the issue of conversation today, but one of the things you learn if you look into this a little bit is that if you go to buy a new set of tires in the state of Minnesota, the retailer will generally ask you if you'd like them to hold on to and discard the old tires on your behalf. And you can pay a fee of somewhere between $4 and $5 per tire to have the retailer hold on to those. And a lot of people participate in that. But many don't, thinking, gosh, if it's going to add $20 to the set of tires, I'll get rid of them through alternate means. And because you can't put them in a landfill or into your garbage at the end of the week, those tires, unfortunately, are disposed of in alternate means in the form of dumping. When it's easier to do the wrong thing, people generally will. If it's less convenient to do the right thing, it's a little bit difficult for people to get their head around doing the right thing. When people are exposed to the opportunity to recycle or dispose of properly on the way into or out of a retail location where they've actually gotten those bags, gotten a plastic bag, that just seems to me to kind of be a common sense way of promoting responsible use of that packaging.
Very good. Are there any questions for Mr. Anderson? Other witnesses, Senator?
Not proponents that I'm aware of, but I know that there are opponents, and I'd be happy to have them join us.
Are there any additional proponents? Why don't we, in the audience, why don't you go ahead and approach real quick, and then we'll move to the opponents. Senator Parisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Reston, earlier in your discussion, I heard people wondering how, or maybe I was reading at the same time on your bill about how they get out the plastic bags especially. I live on a windy ridge, and it's windy all year long. And you can look out anytime, any place, and see some plastic floating around in the air or all splitting across the ground or being dragged by a dog or some other animal. So wind takes care of a lot of it if it just gets loose once.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Caruso, there's no perfect statute or perfect what we're going to be hearing from opponents about recycling programs that have been taken on voluntarily, and there's no perfect program that's going to get rid of every piece of litter,
right,
because we know that ultimately each of us is only responsible for our own behavior, and if you want to litter, no law, no voluntary recycling program is going to prevent you from doing that. And the wind, indeed, can be a culprit, even when you have attempted to act responsibly.
Mr. Anderson.
Another reason that I spoke up and dropped a letter to Senator Rest in the first place is just the common sense aspect of this. And I'm just a Minnesotan, and so forgive me for looking at this in the most simple possible terms, but when I flip through the newspaper, watch the news, I see all of the chatter about what are we going to do with the legacy money, what are we going to do with the money from the lottery that's devoted to the environmental part of our budget and so on, and all of that is kind of hard to follow. But it does seem to me as just somebody on the outside that very often a fund or a budget can kind of turn into a cookie jar pretty fast, and a lot of hands go into it. And I think this is an issue that does not need to be that. It doesn't need to be an expensive thing to deploy. You know, the bottom line is that essentially the manufacturer knows that on the day that bag is born, it is trash. It's going to make basically one trip home from the store carrying whatever consumables the consumer purchased. And basically that's it. On a real good day, it's going to also be used to take somebody's sandwich to and from the office or whatever. It'll get maybe a couple of uses. But this was junk on the day it was born. It's easy to assume that a certain number of these will be disposed of properly. It would seem to me that you could call it a predictable byproduct of producing these materials that there's going to be some of it that's not handled in the right way. It would seem to me just logical that if we can take whatever reasonable steps necessary to handle it correctly to the extent that we can, raise awareness, make it very easy for the consumer to dispose of it the right way, and it just be one step. While there's many more required, at least it's one easy step. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Quilis, Mr. Blazer, Ms. Poole. I have a John Schmitz as well that would like to testify.
Mr. Chairman, Tony Quilis, Director of Environmental Policy from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm just here to highlight a program that we have at the Chamber of Commerce with one of our affiliates, Minnesota WasteWise, and Mark Blazer, who is the Executive Director of Minnesota WasteWise, is here today to speak about that. It's a voluntary program that we put on there that addresses many of the concerns we think that Mr. Anderson has just pointed out. And like I said, I'd like to introduce Mr. Blazer to give you a little bit more detail on that program.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. As Tony mentioned, we manage. Oh, my name is Mark Blazer, Executive Director of Minnesota WasteWise.
Okay.
We manage the It's in the Bag program. Back in 2003, Super Value came to WasteWise and wanted to create a solution for their consumers to recycle their bags. So we started that program up, and I put in front of everybody this is our webpage on the It's in the Bag program. So it's the front and the back of that sheet. And basically it goes over, again, Minnesota WasteWise, we are an affiliate program of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and we designed the It's in the Bag program to collect consumer plastic bags here in the Twin Cities area. Right now, it's in the Cub stores, Kowalski's, Buyer Leland's, festivals, some other smaller grocery stores throughout the Twin Cities metro area. Rainbow Foods did not participate because they have their own program. So that's the other big grocery store in the Twin Cities metro area. Since the inception of the program in October of 2003, and I actually just got the updated numbers today, we're over 5 million pounds of plastic bags and film have been recycled through the program. And all that material is collected by a nonprofit program called Merrick, Inc., and they employ adults with disabilities. So they go out, they have job crew leaders, and they go out and collect the bags at each grocery store or each participating business. We also offer the program to businesses that generate the stretch wrap waste, so they can recycle that film. It's a number four low-density polyethylene. They can recycle through the program as well. The Merrick crews then bring the bags back to their facility, and they sort the material. And this is where the challenge has always been with plastic bag recycling is it's really labor-intensive. You have to sort through the material, make sure it's dry, free of contaminants. The Merrick crews have found everything from car keys to lots of things that they sort out. And once they have the clean material, then they put it into a baler, and then they bale the each bale then gets set on a semi-trailer that is spotted by the Trex company that manufactures the plastic decking or Adirondack chairs, that type of material. And that's all. That's a product that's made here in the U.S., gets shipped down to Tennessee. And that's, again, one of the components of the program. We wanted to make sure we're trying to keep it local here in the United States. So, again, we're at around 1 million pounds of plastic bags and film that are recycled here just in the Twin Cities annually. We are taking this program and going to start expanding it into other communities across the state of Minnesota. In the past, it's transportation is a big barrier with the program, or challenge, I should say, trucking the material back and forth, especially when gas prices were at $4 a gallon, it wasn't really feasible to expand the program. So now with gas prices where they're at, we do have other vocational centers that are coming to us wanting to have this program in their community. And Duluth is the first community that we're going to look at and really try to help get the program going up. Our goal is to have it in 10 other communities across the state of Minnesota by the end of this year. So hopefully we can get that ramped up. And we are partnering with the Recycling Association of Minnesota. They have a program called Message in the Bottle, and that's where they recycle bottles and cans at convenience stores. So they use the same type of infrastructure for that program. So that's why we're partnering together with Recycling Association of Minnesota. We're able to make it a little more viable for these vocational centers to implement these programs at their facilities. So the overhead of trucks and staff and balers and whatnot, all that infrastructure that needs to go into a program to make it successful, we're able to do in partnership with them, so it makes it a little bit easier to get both programs up and running in these communities across the state. Again, our goal is to have it in 10 communities by the end of this year. Hopefully that'll happen. The price of, as everyone here may know, recycling markets have dropped pretty dramatically. But the Trex company has, they want to stay committed to our program because they want to address, they know it's a good program, it's a win-win-win, and they want to continue to support it. So even though they don't need the material, they've informed us they don't really need any more material at this point. They're turning away a lot of folks. They want to continue to support our program here in Minnesota.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your conversations with the manufacturers, are they willing or moving toward biodegradable bags?
Mr. Blazer. Senator, when you say manufacturers,
those who make the bags.
I don't really have conversations with those that make the bags. We focus on just the retail stores that want to participate in the program, and with the Merrick company for the sorting, and then with Trex to make sure that we're getting them the material that can be recycled through the program. They don't, if the biodegradable bags have to be sorted out, so that's it's something that the Trex company doesn't want in their product.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I really do appreciate this program, but I have just a couple of questions that maybe he has answers to. The 5 billion pounds since 2003, do you know approximately what percentage that is of the plastic bags that are issued and used? And I bring that up because, again, from Senator Anderson's research, there was a study done in California that indicated that Americans use 84 billion plastic bags annually. Now, that's the number of bags, not the weight, so there would have to be a conversion there. But I just wonder, on a voluntary basis, what is the percentage that you all estimate it, that you get back from your program?
Mr. Blaine. Thank you, Senator. That's a great question. We don't have that data.
I think eventually, Mr. Chairman, and sir, that would really be interesting information for this committee to have. And you mentioned working in Duluth. Doesn't Duluth already have a recycling program?
You know, we tried to, over the past couple of years, I've been working with Western Lake Superior Sanitary District on creating a program. When we did our last batch of bins, manufacturing the bins, WSSD came in and managed, they got 20 bins for them made in, through our process so they could keep the cost low. So they have everything ready, but they can't find a recycler to take the material. So that's because it's not a wanted material right now, and so that's where we're going up, actually meeting with them real soon to part. We're essentially partnering with them to, because the Trex company is committed to this program, they will purchase the material.
And then, Mr. Chairman, just one final question. In the bill, as I just amended it, dealing with Greater Minnesota, to ask the PCA to study and see if there are ways of working with communities in Greater Minnesota. And I wonder, of the communities now that you're approaching, how many of them, again, are in Greater Minnesota as opposed to the seven-county metropolitan area?
Yeah, most of the 10 that we have targeted are in Greater Minnesota. Yep. Because this program, Mayor Cruz do pickups in the whole Twin Cities metro area. So we have.
So you're going beyond the Twin Cities area now?
Well, I think the furthest one is Prior Lake. There's a village market in Prior Lake that we'd pick up.
Well, that's in the 7th.
Yeah, so it's in the.
So there are none.
Currently, this program is just for the Twin Cities metro area. And then we're targeting 10 more communities in Greater Minnesota, such as Duluth, St. Cloud, Mankato.
Oh, that's
Rochester.
What I was asking. So you are doing beyond that.
Correct.
And I think, you know, asking the PCA to look into ways in which that actually can happen is a good way to be helpful in that effort as well. Even though I know you oppose the bill, but I think I don't think any of us wants to have less recycling. We want more opportunities. We want more biodegradable. We want more people carrying around to buy their groceries and you know, pay 99 cents for a bag that you can use a dozen or two dozen times before it falls apart. I mean, they're not all that sturdy. But I think this is an ongoing issue for all of us, and the voluntary approach is one thing, but I think we also need to make sure that it responds to the values we have as Minnesotans about our environment, and it would be really important to know just how much the voluntary program, how successful the voluntary program is, not just outright, but as a percentage of the waste that's produced.
By what date do you will those 10 additional locations be established?
Our goal is yet in 2009. Funding is obviously always one of the concerns, so that making sure that vocational center has the ability to set up, if they have, you know, the logistics, the ability to, the transportation costs. Right now it's a $6 charge pickup fee for each participating location in the Twin Cities, and that essentially just, as Merrick's a nonprofit, we're a nonprofit, it's all just, it goes into program costs. So, you know, that's our goal, and we're going to try really hard to achieve that.
How many additional locations were established in 2008?
Mr. Chair, no other locations were. Well, there's, I take that back. There's been one other program that in Waconia and Hutchinson that has been established, but that's mainly for, that was with the Message in the Bottle partnership. And there are a couple of grocery stores that participate in that one. That's a focus on that, and that's where this partnership with Recycling Association of Minnesota really stemmed from, was out of this and showing success with that.
Okay. Any other questions for the witness? All right. Did Ms. Poole want to testify? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Poole, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Grocers Association. The MGA is a trade association representing the food retail industry since 1897. We have over 200 retail members with nearly 1,000 stores statewide and approximately 100 distribution and manufacturer members. Our member companies employ over 85,000 union and non-union Minnesotans. Consumers' wants and needs demands drive the business of the community grocer and retailer. Grocers, retailers, waste haulers, government, and consumers must all work together to create viable, easy ways to encourage recycling and reduce waste. Last year, we listened to the members of this very committee tell us to work towards closing the loop on plastic bags. We are proud to report that we have initiated programs that have helped businesses and consumers reduce, reuse, and recycle. All MGA grocers offer reusable bags, and the sales of these have more than doubled in the last year. This has led to a 13.3% reduction in the consumption of plastic bags, and about two-thirds of MGA polled grocers offer a wide variety of financial incentives for reusing their bags. Additionally, there are several programs throughout the state that our suppliers offer. They offer bins, and they voluntarily collect and recycle the plastics. The several suppliers are collecting bags from retailers. This reduces their carbon footprint as well by hauling these plastic bags back to their distribution centers rather than an empty trailer. An independent rural grocer with a green heart offers recycling bags and personally makes the trip back to Merrick in order to make sure that they are done through the Green Jobs Program. As you heard from Mark, the It's in the Bag program is funded voluntarily by retail members throughout the state. This was created in 2003, and the Minnesota Grocers Association is proud to be a partner and support that. And we are also working to help support that growth through 2009. This year, at the Minnesota State Fair, in partnership with Pollution Control and the Echo Experience, the Minnesota Grocers Association, on behalf of its members, encouraged fair goers to be photographed committing to a greener lifestyle. To support the commitment, the MGA gave away 25,000 reusable bags like this. The MGA also donated staff support, taking pictures of Minnesotans with their bags, posting it on a website as a fun, interactive reminder of their green commitment. We've met with the City of St. Paul in an effort to think outside the box and try to figure out ways to supply reusable bags to traditionally underserved communities. One strategy being considered is an education at the city's many unique festivals, as well as giving away reusable bags at neighborhood cleanup days. By no means are we near the finish line, but we have made significant strides in the last year and since we last sat in these chairs. Grocers have voluntarily borne the costs of their current recycling programs. These have been successful at removing plastics from the solid waste stream. It is not necessary to require additional record keeping for what we're doing voluntarily. These requirements would create additional costs, be labor intensive, and quite difficult to track. As we heard from Mark, when these bags are sorted through, unfortunately, sometimes it's not pure plastic. By bringing this back into our stores, weighing it, we don't know if it is actually plastics. There could be trash in there. There could be additional things. That's why we support programs like the Merrick, where we're able to offer green disabled jobs to sort through that plastic. Again, bringing the waste into our stores, we don't have the man hours or the facilities to weigh this. These bags also contain toilet paper wrappings, newspaper wrappings, dry cleaning bags, multiple types of plastic. So we're not even actually really testing that it is the plastic bags. There's multiple types of plastics being recycled there. Unfortunately, legislation will not solve the litter problem. There are many fines in place for litter bugs. Retail stores, government, and state governments have teamed to create opportunities for proper disposals. The Minnesota Grocers Association believes educating consumers is a critical step in achieving a tangible waste reduction results. In that vein, the MGA also received a grant from the PCA to start a public awareness campaign and encourage reuse in order to cut down on plastics in the solid waste stream. This public campaign begins in April. Consumers will go out on our website, let us know the challenges that they have in recycling, and receive a complimentary bag. When they send in a card committing to 6 reuses, they'll be registered in a drawing to get complimentary groceries. This is an outstanding opportunity, again, to engage consumers in the process. In closing, we think it's notable, and we'd like to thank Mr. Anderson for his tired work in keeping our rivers clean. Minnesota is fortunate to have dedicated residents like him and his wife giving up their time to clean up after others. We do not believe that a mandate is the solution or necessary, and we believe that all merchants who offer plastic bags can work together to find a thoughtful, feasible, and easy solution. The entire retail community cares deeply about its consumers, its environment, and leaving Minnesota a little cleaner than we found it. Committee, I thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Questions for the witness, Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, maybe you could help me. I represent the southern part of Minnesota. I'm actually 3 states. And my phone's emails ringing off the hook over on this bill, especially on this bill. What more do you want to put on grocery stores who are struggling outstate to make a living now? I know grocery stores, probably if they make 1 to 2%, they're doing very good, even if they make that. So I just want to be sure that what I vote on here, and I know the amendment made it better, but it's still... But still, unless I'm not reading it right, makes them be a collector. And I'm not too sure that they want to do that. I'm not too sure I can do that.
Mr. Chairman,
we
and
we can work
Senator
together
Vickerman,
on it, but I think that's the part that bothers me the most.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Vickerman, the amendment, I think, recognizes that there is a different challenge in greater Minnesota to do this than there is in the metropolitan area. And so the Pollution Control Agency Commissioner is just to study and recommend solutions to litter in the greater Minnesota area rather than outside of the 7-county metropolitan area, rather than imposing the mandate that is indeed imposed in the rest of the bill. And once again, Mr. Chairman, I think what the grocers are doing is very commendable. What we don't seem to have our hands on is, 13% reduction, but what does that mean? And what does it mean to collect 5 million pounds of waste relative to what the waste stream is? So is that a little bit? Is that half? Is it a lot? Is it a lot? Is it almost all? That's not clear from the numbers that they present to us, even though I commend them on the outreach efforts that they're making to the public. Eventually, I mean, it is the bottom line, and not having to produce and hand out those plastic bags, having people use the reusable ones, has got to be it's got to come out on the bottom line, and it is it less expensive for them to do that.
So the recycling requirements in your bill only apply to the metro?
By the amendment that the committee was kind enough to adopt.
All right. Thank you. Senator Stumpf?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. Is it Ms. Poole? In many of the stores that I end up going to, I see where they give you an option between, let's say, a paper bag or plastic bag. Is there much of a cost difference between the paper bag, and then I'm assuming that the paper bag is more environmentally friendly than the plastic bag. But I'm interested in the cost.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the paper bag is more expensive than a plastic bag. And actually, the carbon footprint of each of them is actually a neutral carbon footprint when you calculate in weight how much goes into making each of them, the cost to ship them, and what actually happens to them in the landfill. It actually is a neutral carbon footprint. And I do have some stats that I could certainly provide the committee to that.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, why do they offer the paper bag if it costs more?
Ms. Poole.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, consumer choice. Consumers, that is the driver for most all things that happen in the grocery stores, what the consumers ask for. Paper bags have been around a long time. The plastic bags came in the 70s, so it is what we answer for our consumers' needs.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Poole, I appreciate the progress that you're making. I just wonder, what are the specific concerns you have about the details of the bill? Because I think I heard you mostly talk about the weighing and the record keeping, and I just sort of want to boil it down to the real basics here. I mean, I think at a minimum, every store should have a bin. And I'm just thinking about this and thinking about trash, you know. We don't have to tell public places or grocery stores that they should have a trash can and that they should get that trash emptied every day, right? I mean, that's kind of obvious. To me, this is a similar thing, except that it's direct packaging that comes from store products. Would you object if we just said that every grocery store that meets the definition in this bill in the metro would have to have a recycling bin for plastics and bring them to a recycling facility? I mean, that's sort of the bare bones of that I think is the most important thing. Is that something that you think you could live with?
Ms. Poole.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think that first of all, it's not just grocery stores. It is also retail, any five
Correct.
Or more. And I think there's other challenges with that bill. The retailers aren't here to speak, but I think there's some challenges in that piece of it. I do know that in the 7-County Metro, most all grocers are offering these bins. They are offering mechanisms that, you know, sometimes that is transported. The recycling product is transported out of state to a distribution center somewhere else, but that is being done. I think, obviously, the record keeping is a challenge for us, but I do think there's still some challenges with the chain stores, the number of stores, and the square footage as well.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair. Uh-huh. Yeah, I know you can just speak for the grocery stores. And so
right.
I guess I'm trying to boil this down to what we could find as common ground here so that we could move forward. I mean, I appreciate that Senator Rest has picked up the ball on this bill that I worked on last session, and I can't tell you how many people I heard from during the interim who said, did you do something about plastic bags? Thank you. And I was like, well, didn't quite finish the job, but we're getting there. And I think there's a growing public acceptance that we need to take action. And this is an approach that just works with, you know, individual responsibility is a big part of it. So it takes the consumer doing their part as well. What if it was just, you know, every store had a bin, and then they had to bring it to their local recycling center? That doesn't seem like too much to ask.
Ms. Poole.
Mr. Chair, Senator, again, I still think there are challenges. We are concerned with setting a mandate as a precedent, but we do certainly appreciate the responsibility and have, in wherever it is feasible, we've offered that and we will continue to offer that. I mean, this is an ongoing challenge that we want to work with all partners to come up with a solution, and I would certainly welcome the opportunity to have additional conversations about how we could come around this, bringing in the other partners that this bill affects. And as I say, we are doing this, and it isn't necessarily bringing it to a recycling center. We bring it back to our distribution centers as well, but we are offering it throughout our grocery chains.
Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is to Senator Rest or Ms. Poole or even Senator Anderson. So last year, the program that you're speaking of, did that come out of our discussions last year? Was anything accomplished in law last year, or it was just a decision that you were going to do the program that you did, or Senator Rest, can you help me out on that?
Senator Rest. Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson can speak best to that about the progress that was made in statute with regard to this bill, but I don't believe we put anything in the law, but I would defer to Senator Anderson.
Yes, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxhog, that's correct. We basically adopted these amendments, passed it out of this committee, and the bill had some other committees to go to, and I just ran out of time basically to work on it, and I knew it was going to take some more discussions and negotiation to try to find a bill that we could get more of a consensus around. And so I'm just, yeah, so that's where it ended, and I'm not sure in the House what happened, but it didn't pass yet. And I know the individual establishments are trying to improve, but we also know there's lots of them around our communities that do nothing about plastic bag recycling, nothing. And, you know, I could name stores that I go to that don't do anything, and we all have been to those, but I don't need to name names today. I think it's...
Mr. Chairman,
we need to make some more progress than we're making.
Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to have the bill stay in this committee while those conversations keep going and talking with the retailers and Ms. Poole about the progress they've been making, Ms. Blazer, and see if we can come to a common agreement without moving the bill along.
Okay. John Schmitz wanted to testify, and let's take him, and then we'll continue the discussion. Thank you, Ms.
Thank
Poole.
You.
It's on the list already.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
John Schmitz with Genesis Recycling. We're a recycling company where we do agriculture and horticultural film from your silage bag to boat film, hay bale wrap, and we also recycle these grocery bags. This plant will be up and running in the middle of May. That is going to create, in a four-year period, 300 jobs. Down at our site. So this grocery bag, we're actually taking this material in as we speak with our silage bag material throughout our state, Wisconsin, Iowa, all the way out to the East Coast down to Florida on there. So there's a lot of material that's out there. We cover all the logistics through our office, coordinating with counties and different cities in our own state. All the way from Houston to Sioux Falls, all the way up to Roseau, over to Duluth, and then back down.
What is the name of your company again, and where is the plant located?
Our new location is going to be in Cannon Falls, Minnesota. We used to be in Savage, Minnesota, and we are relocating right now.
And the company's name is?
Genesis Recycling.
Genesis.
And we used to be AGSI Recycling, is what the company used to be, but we formed a new company and moved down to southern Minnesota.
What do you recycle the bags into?
Right now, the equipment comes back in, and we're having someone else do this for us right now. We take this material and put it back in a uniform pellet, and we send it back out to different manufacturers here in Minnesota and Wisconsin and all over the United States. So they can make new product back out of this material.
What are some typical products that would be made out of your
right now,
material?
Well, to start off, the flower pot recycling in Minnesota, we were doing that. Right now we're making minnow scoops with it, coat hangers to a bunch of different material. The LDPE film from edging to troughs for feed for cattle. And that's really where our focus and where our company is going for the manufacturing side is back into the agricultural part of it.
And you get your products delivered to you from all over?
Correct. We got test pilot programs in Minnesota where we're last year in 8 weeks we did 420,000 pounds of silage bag, hay bale, wrap, bunker film out on the farms that the farmers brought in. now is up in Stearns County. We've collected that material throughout the entire state. We collected in low over 3 million pounds last year in this material total. And then we also had other programs where we did the pesticide recycling containers too, a lot of other materials. We also set up programs like Minnetonka, Roseville. They would have where the public could bring in their plastic material on a weekend, and we would be out there, did a collections with them, and recycled 1 through 6s.
And are you saying that your, at least from your company's perspective, you could use more?
We can take up to 50 million pounds a year through our facility once it's up and running in May.
Maybe you can answer this question about the volume of plastic bags. If you can take 50 million pounds of plastic, what are we talking in just terms of plastic bags? If you know the answer, do you have any idea? How much is 4.5 million pounds of plastic bags?
A lot of truckloads down there. I can't answer that question to you.
Right. If you have any knowledge in terms of percentage of how much is out there?
I really don't have
that
answer.
That's fine. I was just curious if you knew or not. Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, sir, Bill. I'm sorry, what was your last name?
Schmitz.
Schmitz, sorry about that. I forgot. You said you could take up to 50 million pounds, and how many pounds do you take now normally in a given year?
Mr. Schmitz?
Up to 50 million pounds is what we can take up to.
But how much, Mr. Chair, Mr. Schmitz, how much did you take, like, last year?
Last year, total material that we took into our facility was a little over 20 million pounds.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Schmitz, if you doubled the amount or whatever, if you went up to that limit of 50 million, would you be adding workers on to
The first phase is 100 employees on this first phase. When we step into the second phase with the more equipment and the manufacturing capability, we are going up to 300 jobs. So, and that will be within a 3 to 4 year period of creating this.
Senator Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schmitz?
Yes.
Do you go around farm to farm and pick up this material, if you pick it up at a certain site, does a farmer need to containerize it somehow, tie it up? I mean, I see these bags bowling around, and they're kind of, after they've been used, do they get rolled up and tied up with some twine, or how do you?
Farmers bring it into our drop place. We work with a lot of different co-ops, counties, where they'll actually do the collections, and then we'll find somebody out in that area that could actually bale the material for us, because you got to cube out a truck with where the cost of fuel was at the time, but now it's not. Fuel isn't that bad right now, but it's still cost-effective to get the material baled. So on the silage bag part and the hay bale wrap, we would have a drop site, and then we would get it brought into a location down in that area to get it baled, and then we would make a route with a truck to go around and do our pickups and pick up the material.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Smith, is there a charge to the person that's supplying the plastic?
No.
Mr. Schmitz?
No.
It's a free pickup?
It is a free pickup, yes.
Okay.
And right now, last year we got grant funds from the Ag Department. We work very closely with Ag, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, on a lot of different projects in the state. So actually, they called me this morning and wanted me to come to this, so that's why I'm here.
Thank you. Senator Fredrickson, did you have your hand up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was going to make a comment. I was actually going to answer a question that Senator Anderson asked me last year, to which I did not have an answer. The Hy-Vee store in New Ulm has two big plastic recycling bins by their entrance doors, and I know a lot of people use them. I use them. Senator Anderson asked me where they go from there once they collect the bags. And as was stated earlier, they just go into one of the trucks going back to the distribution center in Iowa, and they just truck them back to Iowa where they're processed. I talked to one of the managers of the store, and the manager didn't think it was any big deal at all to do that. It looks pretty simple. So So they go to Iowa, Senator Anderson.
Senator Sharon?
Remembered. Yes, I have a couple of questions. Just to follow up on Senator, the distribution center, are you talking about the distribution center, the place that makes the plastic bags in the first place?
Senator Sharon, no, back to the distribution from where their groceries come from, and they didn't know where they went from there, but I assume you can assume they're going to a recycling, plastic recycling center from there. And the trucks go back and forth anyway, you know, they're delivering groceries and they go back empty, so there's lots of room to haul bags.
Sure.
Thank you, Senator Chaudhry. I'm not sure if you can answer this question, Mr. Schmitz, or if it really, or maybe Senator Rest or Ms. Jamie Fool, but on this issue of where the plastic bags are generated from in the first place, whether they're for groceries or for newspapers or for other products, is there anything that you've considered in this bill or in this discussion about tracking the weight at the time of purchase of these products so that we begin to have some kind of measure of the volume of this product that people are purchasing in order to either bag their product or give the bag to a customer? It seems to me we ought to be able to know what people are purchasing in terms of plastic products in weight so that we have a baseline against which we're measuring how much we're removing from the waste stream through a recycling process, whether it's voluntary or in statute.
Ms. Poole, why don't you approach, maybe if you have any answers to these questions.
And Mr. Chairman, while she's coming forward, thank you. Senator Sharon, that was kind of the questions I was asking Mr. Blazer, too. I mean, what does 5 million pounds represent as a
We'll get you another chair.
Portion of the bags that are actually used in Minnesota. There's at least some indication that about 60% of the plastic bags do come from grocery stores. But the translation to what from poundage that's recovered and recycled to talking about the numbers, I don't see that we have a number of bags that we have good enough information on that to know whether 5 million bags or 5 million pounds is a really astounding number, or is it 2%? I mean, we're not getting, in terms of people that have knowledge about this area, the equivalencies that I think we really need to understand just how big a problem it is.
I seem to recall us asking the same question last year, too. Anyway, Ms. Poole.
Mr. Chair, first of all, just to the Senator's point, we do have three large distributors in the state that bring groceries to the grocery stores, and they do all offer the pickup back. That is then brought back to those distribution centers. They're in Nebraska, Iowa, and here in Eden Prairie. Those are then sent back to either rebag recycling to Trex, and they have the relationship back to see that that product is then recycled, to answer that question. Secondly, I think the biggest challenge in coming up with a solution is that plastic in isn't even plastic out, because we are trying to recycle so much more plastic than simply plastic bags, because it is dry cleaner bags and newspaper bags and the wrap that your toilet paper comes in or your bottles or all of that is actually coming back in through the stream, where I think that is, again, another record-keeping question, and I don't know, honestly, that we have the solution to how to do weight in, weight out.
May I follow up?
Why couldn't you just apply, at least for the moment, apply the same standards to whatever bin is in each store as you have with the WasteWise program? Just have a sign that said this is acceptable material and this is not, and have those.
Mr. Chair, we do have those. If they're not on the WasteWise program, there is a similar bin that is supplied by their other folks that do have that same look and saying on them as well. But the WasteWise folks measure, they've got the MERIC where they're measuring that at that point. When it goes back through a distribution chain, it goes to Iowa, and then it goes back out through, and that's where I think the challenge and the record-keeping comes in.
Okay. All right. Senator Sharon?
I'm going to try another time because I'm not clear about this yet. It seems to me that a grocery store or a dry cleaning store, any store that purchases plastic bags, it might not hit all the plastic around toilet paper and those things, but where you buy a bag that you're putting on dry cleaning or putting you're giving to your customers to put something in, that you're purchasing that you're buying that, and you're buying that by weight, probably. And it seems to me that in those places where that is purchased, we ought to be able to have those weights recorded. Either the manufacturer of the plastic bag has to record how the weight of plastic sold in the state of Minnesota to various places, or purchasers record and report the weight, because even though it doesn't capture everything, we could begin to get a sense of the size of this problem so that when we recycle, we're able to measure how much of that waste stream we are recapturing.
So, Ms. Poole, how many pounds of plastic bags are purchased by grocery stores in Minnesota each year?
And, Chair, Senator, I don't have the answers to that, but certainly we can. I mean, I'm guessing that's something that we could work on getting an answer to. I honestly don't know how the manufacturer sells it. I would assume it could be by bag, could be by weight, but I'm sure they must know how much a bag weighs. So we will work on getting that answer through Senator back to the committee.
So then how can one assert that tremendous progress has been made over the last year with 4.5 million pounds of plastic bags and film being recycled since 2003 if we don't know how many pounds of plastic bags have been purchased in the first place? How are you measuring that progress?
I mean, Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. that is being just measured through what's coming into Merrick, and I guess we're using a measurable in from before the WasteWise program. There was no real form of the bags being recycled, so we see that as a success, and that's really our measurable right now.
All right. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, just one final thing, and thank you for the amount of time and attention you're taking with this bill. In a fact sheet that was provided by Senator Anderson last year, in terms of an approximation, the fact was given that there were in Minnesota that Minnesotans use 2.8 billion. Plastic bags each year that creates over 21,000 tons of unnecessary waste, and a quick multiplication of that leads to 4.2 million pounds of waste in plastic bags annually. So the WasteWise has over 6 years, 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, has managed to get to the point of 1/6 of the waste in that period if they started in 2003.
Okay.
Just rough.
Mr. Blazer, Senator Anderson, then I think we should move on.
Mr. Chair, Senator, just would like to make sure that it's known that It's in the Bags is one program or one small. One example
just
is
to understand the magnitude of what you've collected.
Yeah. The Super Value, they're taking on their own program again, so none of our numbers we're slowly going off. The Super Values saw the Cubs, so they have their own programs. The Rainbows have their own programs. And the Hy-Vees have their own programs. So all those numbers aren't a part of our, you know, 5 million. So just something to keep in mind as well.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up on something Ms. Poole said very briefly, just one question. She talked about, and she was following up on what Senator Fredrickson said and the distribution network, and you mentioned three distribution locations that serve some grocery stores in Minnesota that will pick up the bags, mm-hmm. and it sounded like without a charge to the stores. So why not have everyone do that? I mean, that sounds like a pretty simple solution for stores, just to collect them and send them back in those empty trucks.
Ms. Poole?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I actually believe that from our numbers and what we found out from our members, that is available to all stores, and they are taking advantage of that.
Except for, Mr. Chair, except for the ones that aren't. And you don't want us to tell them to do it. I understand that. But that seems to me might be the simplest way that we could set up a structure in the law that would be effective and simple and very, very low cost, no cost to the grocers.
Senator Rest, final comments, and then tell us how you'd like to proceed.
No, Mr. Chairman, once again, I want to thank the committee's time, and I do appreciate particularly Mr. Anderson coming to me and the opportunity to work with Senator Anderson, who certainly has been a leader in this area. And my preference, with your permission, would be not to move the bill on to another committee, but to keep it here and see if we can come up with some sort of simple directive that could be a good step forward in recycling and for plastic in Minnesota. So, Mr. Chairman, I would appreciate it if you could lay the bill over and perhaps consider a compromise position in your omnibus bill.
All right. Senate File 267 is laid over for further consideration.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your participation. Okay. Senate File 105.
What have you got going on? Good compromise.
Oh, we got show some courtesy to the next witnesses. Welcome to the committee, Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Senate File 105 is a very simple bill to kind of take care of a kind of a small issue, but important issue when it comes to the enforcement of some of our game and fish laws. Now, I believe that Mr. Knopf has
coming around.
Okay, there's an amendment.
Author's amendment?
Yes.
All right. We move the author's amendment. Senator Fredrickson moved the A1. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Murphy?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Conrad is here, who is the chief enforcement agent at the DNR, to help explain a little bit about this bill. But I can tell you what's going on just from my experience and from the experience of the enforcement agents in my neck of the woods. Last year we changed this chapter of law so that folks that were using bird feeders didn't get caught up in this law. Now, this law only pertains to, you know, hunting over a bird feeder. And I think that maybe last year we might have went a little too far, but this cleans it up, and I think that most of the people that are involved in this, even the Deer Hunters Association, doesn't have much heartburn. They're neutral on the issue. They had mentioned that maybe we needed to fix up a couple things, but I think in discussions that we've had, they're pretty comfortable with where we're at now. Members, a couple things that happened. My enforcement agent came to see me when some county attorneys across the state were refusing to prosecute deer baiting. And that's what the crux of the law was all about, was, you know, people who pile up a big, you know, bushel basket full of corn right below their tree stand. We all know that that's probably not an acceptable hunting practice. But anyway, there were some folks that were trying to get away with that. You know, most of that went away. Now what we see because of the law last year is that people are hunting around bird feeders that magically and mysteriously appeared out in the middle of the woods. because they knew because of the law change from last year they couldn't be prosecuted. So this is just a simple bill to try to rectify that and give our enforcement folks a tool in the toolbox. And I'll let Mr. Conrad
Conrad.
A couple remarks here.
For the record, Captain Jim Conrad, Acting Administrative Manager for the Division of Enforcement. I appreciate your support on being the chief, but not quite there yet.
I always try to promote people.
This is a fix that we have been looking for. This bill has evolved over the past few years to address what had been an increasing enforcement issue with the placement of bait and hunting over it. There are numerous different arguments to move towards not allowing that. We won't rehash those here. The amendment that was offered would help clarify the what is bait, what isn't bait, and also allow for some exceptions with normal agricultural practice as well. And it does not prohibit the feeding of deer. It just prohibits the hunting over any feed that deer would be attracted to. And we feel that this bill would address most of those enforcement problems that we have had in the past.
Senator Pariseau.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Conrad, would the kinds of bait that people typically bait bear with even appeal to deer?
Mr.
In
Chair.
Case the overlap was there in some case and they didn't intend for it to be.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Bringing in deer.
There are some overlaps. Obviously, a bear might, in proper circumstances, want to come and eat a pile of apples. Also, corn might be attracted to them. That is not their preferred food. However, with deer, pumpkins, corn, corn seems to be the preferred thing, but piles of spoiled apples and that sort of thing are quite effective. There would be some overlap there, but with bear, we do have registered bait stations so that we know where those are, and you know, you wouldn't be hunting deer over those registered bait seasons. And there's also a little bit of a seasonal issue as well, in that the bear season ends before at least the firearms season for deer begins.
Mr. Chairman, I ask that question because some people start their bear baiting early, and I'm not sure that there could be some kind of misunderstanding about the purpose of it.
Mr. Chair, Senator, our officers are pretty good at determining what a bear bait is as opposed to a deer
it's
bait.
Sweet stuff.
Yeah, sweet stuff, especially. And to be effective, that's the kind of stuff you're going to use. You're going to use a meat or a sweet. And with those baits being registered, very easy for our officers to determine if that's a bear hunter using that pile.
Thank you.
I've got an acreage. Let's say I have an acreage, and my house nearby is a grove of trees, and I like to put out a bird feeder, suet, whatever, to attract the birds to that grove. Under this bill, am I baiting deer?
Mr. Chair, the baiting would only apply if you hunt over that bird feeder. If you want to, we don't care. You can feed as many birds as you want to, have 1,000 bird feeders up in that patch of woods. It's just when you put a stand up in the midst of them and start hunting the deer that are attracted to that spillage or other food there that we do have an issue with it.
I don't need to be in the midst of them. I could be several hundred yards away or 100 yards away. Am I in the midst of them, and am I baiting deer?
Mr. Chair.
Under this bill.
Mr. Chair, no.
Okay. Senator Kielash.
My question is, how much of a problem is this, or how many citations are given in a year or a for this particular baiting?
Mr. Conrad.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't have the exact numbers with me right now, but it has been an increasing issue each year for the past several years. We've seen almost an exponential increase in the violations and certainly in the complaints of deer baiting. I believe we did have a little dip in this year's statistics compared to last year's. So that is encouraging. The language perhaps was going in the right direction. With this language, hopefully we can take another chunk out of that.
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious about ballpark numbers. Are we talking about hundreds? Are we talking about less than 100, or where are we?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we are talking in excess of 100 citations issued. I'm not sure of the number of warnings, but the complaints are in the hundreds.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and to that point, Senator Kelash, my enforcement agent never bothers me, never. And he calls up, says he's got a problem, so.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Murphy, or Mr. Conrad, in the author's amendment, I'm just wondering what is improved by taking out the word unharvested and putting in that has not been placed by a person? I don't quite see it. If it's unharvested food resulting, you're putting back in resulting from normal or accepted farming. Mm-hmm. If it's unharvested, it's other than having been originally planted, the seed been planted by a person. How is that an improvement in language?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, it was the definition of unharvested, which I think was causing some heartburn.
Oh, really?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Conrad.
Senator, we had an issue in, I think it was Goodhue County last year, where the law was challenged on the basis of unharvested food plots. What they had done is they had planted a food plot, which was totally legal to hunt over, and they took the corn from that food plot and then placed it under a stand at a different location and said, well, that's not illegal because it originated from an unharvested food plot. So that's why we went to the wording that says has not been placed by a person.
And you didn't think we read them laws out in the country. And Mr. Chairman, it wasn't me.
Mr.
Chairman, did they prevail? Because it has been harvested now. I mean, if they took it off from an unharvested place and put it somewhere else, it's been harvested.
Mr. Chair, Senator, in that case, a plea was made before it actually went to court, but there was some concern that the individual might have prevailed. And we would rather not waste our officers' time going to court on the wording in the law. We would rather have them out there enforcing those laws.
I think there was a a controversy that got widely reported, and that kind of publicity turned this provision into a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so in any case, if this helps clarify that, then I think that's a good thing. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate file number 105 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
We can do that, Senator Fredrickson. I don't have a problem. I have spoken with my House counterpart. We're interested in keeping the game and fish bills together. We will have a game and fish bill. If that's all right with you, Senator Murphy, to lay this over for inclusion in the game and fish bill, we can do that possible inclusion. But it sounds like it's your bill is acceptable.
Mr. Chairman, I'll amend my motion then retain it in this committee for possible inclusion in the game and fish bill.
That's fine. We don't need a motion. We can just lay it over. If there's any other discussion.
Well, Mr. Chair, do we get to keep the bird feeders?
Those were provided by the chair.
The bird feeders are for you to keep.
They're very cute.
Thank you.
In fact, bird house.
In fact, the bird feeders were not even available, at least at this store. They're not in season yet, so we're ahead of the game.
Until deer season opens.
That's right. Okay, Senate File 105 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Murphy, for bringing this issue forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Fredrickson, you've got some out-of-town witnesses. We'll go ahead and take your bill then.
I do, too.
Senator Stumpf, you do as well.
I was going to ask Murphy about falling off the turnip trucks because they're feeding them turnips now. Turnip truck falling off.
Mr. Chairman, I've asked Dr. Shannon Fisher to join me here at the table right away. He's with Minnesota State University Mankato Water Resources Center. Mr. Chairman, members, the bill before you is about the Minnesota River Board. I want to start by just giving you a brief explanation about the Minnesota River. The Minnesota River flows from the South Dakota-Minnesota border 335 miles to a confluence of the Mississippi River in St. Paul. Its watershed is 16,700-some acres, and of that, almost 15,000 square acres are in the state of Minnesota. The watershed comprises 18.5% of the geographic area of Minnesota, and 29% of the farmable acres in the state are in the Minnesota River watershed. The watershed is all or part of 37 different counties. When the Minnesota River flows into the Mississippi River, the volume of water in the Mississippi River goes up by 50%. And I wanted to give you those numbers or those facts to give you a feel for the size of the Minnesota River and the importance of the Minnesota River to Minnesota. And, of course, it bears the name of our state, the Minnesota River. And there's been, for many decades, a concern about cleaning up the Minnesota River. It goes back many, many, many years. The most recent effort probably started in 1994 when Governor Carlson made the goal of having it fishable and swimmable in 10 years. Now that seems overly ambitious considering everything we've done in the Minnesota River. But we have made a lot of progress in that time, and there's a lot of progress to go yet. When Governor Carlson made that that goal, there was a concern about having it go from the top down, from state agencies down to the local level, and we didn't think that that was a good way to get citizen support and to establish the cleanup. And so there was a Minnesota River Joint Powers Board, it was called then, of 37 counties joining on the Joint Powers Board. Since that time, there have been changes made to that board. Their mission has changed. They see some other things they would like to be doing. So the Senate file before you, 275, makes those changes that were initiated by the Minnesota River Joint Powers Board. And I'll quickly go through the bill for you. I think you'll find that there aren't monumental changes, but there are important changes for the board, and I do have an amendment I'm going to offer after I've gone through the explanation, and I'd ask Dr. Fisher to join me in this explanation if you do have questions. So this bill is to establish efforts from the grassroots up in this cleaning up of the Minnesota River. The bill changes the name of the river from the Joint Powers Board to just the Minnesota River Board, and it says in statute that it's in collaboration with the Water Resources Center at Minnesota State University, Mankato. Establishes the following duties: compiling and submitting to the governor, the legislature, and Bowser comprehensive water quality improvement and watershed management goals. Requires a biennial report highlighting the results of the progress of the 12 major watersheds of the Minnesota River, and periodic basin-wide water quality improvement plans. It adds advising on TMDLs and local water plans on top of page 2. Continues the conducting of public meetings on a quarterly basis. That's a continuing activity. Continue for information and education, and sponsoring and coordinating continuing education opportunities in cooperation with watershed partners, providing periodic reports and budget requests and appropriate committees of the legislature and Bowser, and requests for funding for the efforts of the board.
Number six changes a little bit to coordinating and promoting in partnership on behalf of water quality and watershed management stakeholders, policy development, and makes some other mostly stylistic changes on the balance of page two. Page three, subdivision two, establishes an advisory board. There was a citizens and technical committee that was established originally. That's being changed to an advisory board, and the board is appointed by the chair of the Minnesota River Board, and then the membership on that advisory committee is from a wide diverse group of individuals. I would say somebody in the river basin who is very interested in the river would probably be appointed to this advisory board if they had the information and the interest in doing so. The river board chair would designate a member of the advisory committee to chair the first meeting, and that first meeting would have to be held by December 31st, 2009. That's an amendment I'm going to offer in a minute. And then also in that amendment, it would become effective the day after enactment. So, Mr. Chairman, members, that's a very quick walkthrough of the bill. This is the second committee the bill has been through. It first was heard by the government, state government committee. I love Dr. Sharon Fisher wants to add.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Shannon Fisher. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota River Basin Joint Powers Board, and I'm also the director of the Water Resources Center at Minnesota State University Mankato. I had prepared some comments regarding the changes that we were requesting for the bill, but I think Senator Fredrickson covered most of those in his introduction, and so I have a few other comments regarding the Minnesota River Board and why these are important changes for us, but if there were any specific questions regarding the language changes, I'd be happy to entertain those at this time.
Senator Anderson, that's over.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Senator Fredrickson or Dr. Fisher, sorry, I just stepped out for 1 minute, and I don't know if I missed you say this or not, but would you say the Minnesota River is suitable for fishing and swimming now? Because you're deleting that, and I like that language.
Well,
Fisher,
we're deleting it for the purpose of the fact that that was inserted as a comment by former Governor Arne Carlson and with the 2005 attached to it. Obviously, fishing and swimming are certainly important aspects for what we hope to attain at the Minnesota River, but is it there right now? I can comment that it is certainly better than it used to be, but are we there? No. I mean, we are still working on it. The fishing has greatly improved, and I was actually have some comments about that. And I know there are people utilizing the river at a much higher rate now than they did, say, 10 years ago. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, a follow-up on that.
Yeah.
Senator Fredrickson, I don't know if you have a comment on this. You know, I really would hate to lose that, and I can understand why you'd want to take out by the year 2005. That's obsolete language. But, you know, out of the whole law, that's really the one phrase that would speak to the public about why this matters and what your purpose of your board is. And I wouldn't want us to lose sight of that goal because that's sort of the plain English, you know, that's what we're all hoping to see happen. And so I think that's really important language. I wonder if we could try to keep that in. Senator Fredrickson, has a comment.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I would certainly be agreeable to keep that in. In my mind, what replaced that was the TMDL process,
sure,
where there's a much more statistically accurate measure of cleaning up the water and having implementation plans. But certainly in common use language, fishable and swimming. Swimmable is certainly easier.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson,
maybe I would propose just reinstate the stricken language on lines 10 and 11, except for by the year 2005.
Mr. Chair.
Would that work?
Not quite.
Not quite.
Okay.
Move
Mr.
Knopf.
Mr.
Chairman, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You That's also need to move the word basin after river. On line 1.11, delete basin, and after river on 1.10, insert basin.
Oh, Mr.
Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think you You could also just relocate the reinstated language to after the notion of providing after Mankato.
On line 113.
Yeah, because it's they're providing leadership, building partnerships, supporting watershed districts in collaboration with them, and achieving the goal of making Minnesota. You could reposition it, and I think it kind of flows right with the thought of what's being done.
That is sense, so that's good.
Mr. Knopf, do you have that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I'm wondering, though, aren't the providing leadership, building partnerships, and supporting watershed programs all tied to also the fishable and swimmable portion? That's why I was thinking that we'd keep it in the same location.
One would. Purpose it could be.
Mr. Knopf, do you want to read back what your understanding is?
Well, my understanding, Mr. Chairman, of the amendment would be line 1.10, after river, insert basin, and reinstate the stricken language. And on line 1.11, reinstate the stricken and swimming.
Continue to delete by the year 2005.
Right, you leave the rest of it. Yep. Oh, and then also delete the new language basin. On line 1.11.
That's good. Just amazing to me. Mr. Chair, I would move that language.
All righty. Does everyone understand the Anderson Amendment? All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, I do have the A3 amendment also.
All righty. While that's being passed
out.
That has been passed out.
And there are not substantive changes. It's mainly a stylistic line, 1.2 to 1.10. Then, as I stated in my explanation of the bill, it makes an effective date the day following final enactment, and the first meeting shall be of that advisory committee shall be by December 31st, 2009. I would move the amendment.
Right. On the A3, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, this is kind of technical, but you kind of get technical at times with some of the language. TMDLs, we know what they mean, but I presume that it's defined or spelled out in Chapter 114D, but yes. Is there some merit in saying total maximum daily loads, and then in parens putting the TMDL so that it's clear what you're referring to?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I don't know which would be the preferable way to draft this. Maybe Mr. Knopf could give us.
Well,
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, Senator Fredrickson, TMDL, that is a defined term, the acronym, in Chapter 114D. Mm-hmm. So it was used here to correspond with that, because it's talking about TMDLs under that act, and it is a defined term under that act. You could spell it out if you wanted to. We don't usually put things in parentheses and behind in statutes.
An average reader would wonder what the heck that is if they weren't steeped in this stuff. But maybe nobody's going to be reading the law that isn't steeped in this stuff.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, sometimes we try not to use the acronym if it's not defined here, but since it's referring to it under the Clean Water Legacy Act and it refers to the chapter, I think if somebody wants to know about it, they would be able to find it easily, actually more easily with the acronym.
Mr. Knopf, did you have something else on the A3?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, something else I'd noticed on 3.4 of the bill, it says advisory board, and later on, in the head note, it says advisory board, and later on, everything's talking about the advisory committee. I wonder if that shouldn't be advisory committee rather than advisory board.
Here, this is
in the head note on line 3.4 of the bill.
Different groups.
Mr. Knopf, you're suggesting advisory committee?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, if you look down below on paragraph B, it's called an advisory committee. And I'm just thinking that the head note should reflect that.
You said at least four times in there in that paragraph. Five times.
We've got a board, but then you've got the board appointing an advisory committee.
Mr. Chairman, it's called the Minnesota River Basin Board. And so that, I think with the addition of the new language advisory board, I think at one point you were looking at calling this other thing an advisory board, and that head note is just still a remnant from that. So I just think if you were to delete on 3.4, delete board and insert committee, I think it would be consistent with the with the rest of the section.
Mr. Chairman, I would incorporate that into the amendment, into my amendment.
Isn't the bill establishes the Minnesota River Board, or is amending the Minnesota River Board, and then the on 3.4, the subdivision 2 establishes membership of the board, or is this an advisory committee to the board?
Yes.
I see.
Mr. Chairman,
okay.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Do you want to just incorporate that into your A3 to change that?
Mr. Chairman, I will.
Okay. So the A3 will also include the substitution of board of committee for the word board on line 3.4. Everybody understand the A3? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Dr. Fisher would like to make a couple more comments. Then I have two citizens who would like to talk for just a few minutes about the Minnesota River and the activities, and one individual from Mr. Bob Finley from PCA to talk very briefly about TMDLs in the Minnesota River.
Senator Scogin, did you have more of a technical question before we move on?
Well, no, not real technical, Mr. Chair. Okay. I just, on line 21 on page 2, the middle where landowner support has been stricken, and then on line 2.31, there's no mention of landowners, and I'm wondering if landowners have become a problem in some of the projects that the watershed has wanted to do, and so that they've been kind of carved out of the process.
No, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Fisher.
That was not the intent of striking that language. To be quite honest, when I advised the River Board and Senator Fredrickson how we had hoped this language would be promoted or advocated for, that never even crossed my mind. So I can understand the intent of keeping the landowner support in there. I think one of the big differences is that the River Board, because of the nature of our changing, kind of evolving philosophy and our relationship with soil and water conservation districts and others, is that we're trying to move away from some of the implementation activities, which has been more focused in the SWCDs and the watershed projects. And so, therefore, landowner support is more of an issue, I guess, for those entities, because they're the ones that are actually getting the on-the-ground projects moving. And therefore, I didn't view that as a big concern.
Why don't we move on with the testimony, and then Senator Scogin, if you want to mull over that provision and see if you have any suggestions.
Mr. Chair, while they're
Senator Olson?
Have we totally lost the battle of using the word impact as a verb?
Chairman, Senator Olson, I think so.
Instead of just as a noun?
Yes.
Dr. Fisher, why don't we bring up your additional folks here?
Mr. Chair,
we've got some other people waiting.
Yeah, I greatly appreciate it. I just wanted to take just a couple of minutes to kind of highlight why we feel this overall change is needed. And 2 years ago, I came before this committee and other committees requesting state funding for the Minnesota River Board. Well, as a result of us achieving that funding, the River Board has gone through quite a change or an evolution of sorts. And I just wanted to highlight that some of the work that we have done has been requested by some aspects of the basin, and some other work has just seemed like a natural fit for us to do. Thus, we have changed some of the language to include things like multiple major watersheds, trying to express to our partners that we're really looking at this at the basin level. We're trying to highlight our efforts and our capacity as at a higher level. As a result of the funding that we did receive, we were able to leverage that substantially, generating more than 8,000 hours of water quality credit or water quality training for staff in the basin. And we have also generated about $1.3 million in additional revenue from the federal government and from the private industry. So we've been able to leverage our funding from the state of Minnesota on at least about a 5-to-1 ratio. And the board has really, I think, progressed. There are people in the basin who you may run into who are going to talk about the board of old that was not cooperative and not participatory and failed to meet some of our needs. And I think that board has passed, and that this legislation really really drives home that point. And I think as far as the progress that we've made in the basin, although sometimes it's difficult to put quantitative numbers on it, there are anecdotal things that we see all the time. The biology and the society don't lie, and we have seen a revival of the paddlefish population in the river, just as an example. We are seeing sensitive invertebrates and fishes show up in watersheds where they haven't been seen for quite some time. And the increased activity on the river by the citizens of the basin has been dramatic. And so it's really, I think, those speak volumes for the work of not only the board but all of the various partners in the basin. And therefore, I think this change in the language for the bill helps us capture a better role for the board.
Okay. So Scott Sparlin and Patrick Moore.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Finley.
Senator
Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, you won't be guilty of carrying that grammatical infraction forward because Mr. Knopp pointed out that he has corrected it in the A3 amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, you are right.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Scott Sparlin. I'm the executive director of the Coalition for a Clean Minnesota River and Watershed Initiative Coordinator for Friends of the Minnesota Valley. I live in New Ulm, Minnesota. Thank you for letting me have this opportunity, and I'm very proud of Senator Fredrickson's work as well in the entire state of Minnesota with our environmental things, and thank him for asking me to come today and speak to you about some of the good things that are going on in the Minnesota Basin. Right now, the Minnesota River Basin, there's been a paradigm shift over the past 20 years. I can remember when our movement started 20 years ago, 1988, with the Minnesota River Assessment Project. And that really started the ball rolling, and we went through a series of things such as cultural denial that this was not existing, that the river really wasn't polluted. It's always looked like chocolate milk, and, you know, it's always going to be like that. And that's just, we didn't accept that, and we moved forward. So representing citizens, we have come a long ways, and we're poised right now and excited about the future because of some of the work with our government friends. The Minnesota River Board has been behind many of the initiatives we've taken on. One of the things that we're doing is called Community Cleanups for Water Quality, where we get citizens engaged in communities that are, you know, don't have the ability, the staff, the money to get out and clean our streets. When, you know, it's coming up in about another 3 weeks here, we're going to have a heck of a melt, a snow melt. And that goo that collects on our city streets does not get picked up in time, and it runs to our local waterways, our lakes, our rivers, our streams. And this program is a way to empower citizens to get out and do that themselves and get others to do it. Projects like this are happening all over. In the lower Minnesota River watershed alone, we have 20 communities involved in their project, in that program. And we're also excited about the new technology that's out there regarding agricultural drainage. Some of you may think that conservation and drainage is an oxymoron, but we don't feel that way. We're forging new partnerships with people in the agricultural community, and those people that before were at odds are now talking how we can work together to get things like this moving forward. Conservation drainage does exist, and there is a way to conserve not only our groundwater, increase crop yields, and at the same time improve our water quality. So we're excited, and we're poised and ready for the future. And a great deal of it has to do with the Minnesota River Board and how far they've come. We've watched them mature in the basin. And today, things are looking better anecdotally and as well as data, hard data, scientific data. There's been a 20% drop in sediment in the Minnesota River over the course of the last 25 years. There are old-time river rats coming up to me, in fact, myself included, because I consider myself a river rat. You go down to the river and you scoop it up, and you say in July, you look at the water and you say, hey, you know what, that's better than it was 10 years ago. When you used to be able to see this far down, now you can see this far down. So it's, you know, things like that. And people are excited about it. 100,000 acres of formerly cropped floodland, not flooded cropland, was taken out of production in the Minnesota Basin, and I think that has a lot to do. Those permanent easements are working, and we're seeing more and more in that. So I, at the risk of going on, I'm very passionate and excited about where we're at, and I'm going to turn things over to my good friend and colleague up in the upper part of the Minnesota River Basin, Patrick Moore, to talk to you more.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Patrick Moore. I'm the executive director of Clean Up the River Environment, CURE. Drove in from Montevideo this morning. And I just wanted to let you know about the level of citizen interest and excitement in the Minnesota River. We just had our annual meeting last 3 weeks ago, and we had a 300-person-plus standing-room-only crowd to hear an hour-long lecture by Dr. Sean Schottler about sediment loading in Lake Pepin from the Minnesota River. There is a high level of awareness and engagement. We have more youth involved in canoeing and kayaking the river, and I wanted to let you know that the canoeing and kayak season's coming right up, and we'd love to have you come out and experience what we call the boundary waters of southern Minnesota. There's 3.2 billion-year-old rocks. There are 7 state parks along the river. There are numerous opportunities for county parks and scientific and natural areas. And, of course, there's a National Wildlife Refuge at the head of the river and one at the end. So we feel in the Montevideo area, Milan, Watson, Granite Falls, Ortonville, Redwood Falls, that's kind of where we are focused. We have over 500 members, very engaged. And our perspective is that the Minnesota River is not only the river that bears our state's name, but it's also an indicator river. You know, you all hear about indicator species like the canary in the coal mine. Well, this is an indicator river. If we look at this river, we can find out pretty well how we're doing on the land, how we're doing in other aspects of bringing about a more sustainable ecosystem. The river is the indicator. And so the work that's gone in and the connections between scientists and people and the citizens' monitors that are happening in the Minnesota River watershed to try to bring about this more sustainable watershed is really taking root. We've been in existence for 18 years, and we're growing. We have our best year ever. In fact, we have business support to the extent where we had a prominent business person donate our organization a Main Street building so that we could have a permanent office just recently. So the level of support is growing. And I think the other thing that we look at the river is that this is a bellwether river. What's happening in the Minnesota River is we think is that's got to happen on all rivers all over the country. And it's where you have science, citizen scientists, agencies, all working together and having watershed consciousness and understanding how all of our actions affect water quality. Water, of course, as you all know, is the most precious commodity on the planet. And so we see that this Minnesota River Board is a classic example of how a watershed can organize itself at the most grassroots level with county commissioners working in concert with state agencies, and that where they in turn work in concert with citizen organizations like ourselves to bring about the change in the water quality that we're all looking for. So with that, I just want to thank you for the opportunity and thank you for supporting the Minnesota River Board in this new legislation.
Thank you. I had the opportunity to canoe the Red River last fall.
Minnesota River.
Excuse me, the Minnesota River. A lot of my geologist friends are jealous that I got to touch the oldest exposed rock in the world.
Yes, I understand you were hunting with one of our board members, Dwayne Knutson, too.
Yep.
So.
Yeah.
Fabulous.
Okay. More witnesses, Senator Fredrickson? Senator Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to compliment both the witnesses and for your enthusiasm. And, Mr. Moore, I love reading your emails that come regularly because it sounds like there's always so many fantastic things happening that citizens are involved in, and you make it fun, you know,
right.
Canoes and kayaks and dinners and music and all kinds of good things. So it really is a great model for citizens getting involved in cleaning up our waters. So thank you for all of your work.
It's no joke either. It looks like the boundary waters in a lot of spots. Less canoe traffic, too.
You don't need a permit. You can just drive
you
on.
You don't need
Highway 7. You're on Lake Street, just keep
seven.
Going west.
That 800 number was? Okay. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, the other witness I had is from the Pollution Control Agency, and he was just going to share with you a little bit about the TMDL. But in view of the time, and I know other folks are here for another bill,
perhaps we can hear from him another time when
Thank
there's
you.
A little more time.
Yeah.
So in view of that, I would move that Senate File 275 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Okay. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank
Mr.
you,
Chairman,
Senator.
Members, thank you very much.
Where do you have to go before it looks like the boundary? Upstream, do you have to go?
It's like granite, sacred heart.
Sacred heart.
Granite falls.
Oh, we're on the river. River.
Around
there. Are we doing your bill?
Soda on to the red.
Mm-hmm. Lever is going first because he's got witnesses from outside the metro area, apparently.
He finds money for you.
I thought it was an honor.
Oh,
it
is that. Oh,
you got the water?
Damn big.
Yeah, it's right here. He wants money?
He needs $200,000.
Yeah, my river would turn
Senator Stump, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's take your citizen witnesses first. Not that the others are not citizens, but.
Let me just give 1 minute of introduction. This is a proposal relating to the Red River of the North River Watch, which is a program that has been in place for a number of years. They'll talk about it, and it has to do a lot of similarities between the last proposal that you heard about cleaning up the river. The Red River Watershed District is, I think it's somewhat over 240-plus miles from north to south, and it's the only river that actually flows north, so it goes up into Canada. And, of course, that's part of the problems that we have is that because it does flow north, we do have frequent flooding, and it goes right through the heart of an agricultural area. And, of course, a lot of interest from our Canadian counterpart to the north of us about the river. And we have some students. I take it one step further than what the Minnesota River. We, in fact, this program involves a lot of students in a lot of communities. And I think that's kind of the heart of the essence of this program. So with that, I'd like to introduce Wayne, who is in charge of this program, and let him take over.
Thank you, Senator Stump. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Wayne Gokin with the Red River Watershed Management Board. I'm the monitoring coordinator. And I'll just talk about the River Watch program that we've established, and it's been in existence since 1995. And actually, we got our start through a partnership with the Mississippi Headwaters Board that had a River Watch program at that time, and they helped us get started. It was born of the need for good quality data for watershed districts that did not have monitoring programs in place, as they were trying to get permits and projects in place to measure project effectiveness. And so we started a River Watch program with 4 schools on the Sand Hill River. And since that time, we've expanded the program in 2000 to schools to the north of us towards the Canadian border through a generous Border Water and Soil Resources had a challenge grant. And since that time, the program and all along has been supported by the local watershed districts and the Red River Watershed Management Board, the consortium, the Joint Powers Board of Watershed Districts up in the Red River Basin. And they've been the nucleus of the support for the program all along. But the partnerships have really helped the program grow. We've had great support from the International Water Institute in doing other features of the program. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has been a partner all along as we emphasize the quality control so the data is all scientifically sound. We use the same equipment the students use as what the resource professionals. We train them side by side. So it's all apples to apples when you compare data across the basin. And we're engaging North Dakota and Manitoba schools as well in the program, though the Northwest Minnesota certainly is taking the lead in demonstrating how it can be done through the partnerships. We've also had partnerships with the University of Minnesota. They've developed an online data system that is very excellent that we're still adding more features to it. So there's a lot of opportunity, and so we really stress the rigor in the program so that the data is useful for doing assessments for TMDLs. The PCA has accepted it in that capacity. So we have a great deal of rigor to the program, and emphasizing the STEM skills, the science, technology, engineering, math, it's been shown that students that go through the Riverwatch program test higher in those skills than their counterparts that aren't part of the Riverwatch program. So we have a lot of opportunities that we have going.
So we've kind of laid the foundation of the program, and we also have a strategic leadership team that's made up of students. We want student involvement in everything we do, and teachers and administrators. And they've developed kind of three areas that we want to move forward with that we'll be advancing, and that's developing curriculum. So it's developed directed into the curriculum of the schools so it aligns with the new science standards that are coming out. Right now it's essentially an extracurricular program within each of the schools. We also are looking at applied research components, and that in conjunction with the University of Minnesota, and also the youth leadership community engagement component, and we feel that's critical, and some of the schools have been emphasizing that. So a number of our schools, we have 25 schools now, and that's engages about 200 students a year in the program, and some of them are in the program for 2 to 3 years and get quite adept at understanding the dynamics of watersheds. And that's what the watershed managers also, why they support the program. They recognize these students as being the future leaders in the basin, future watershed managers and citizens, to better understand what the cause effects are in the environment, develop critical thinking skills so that they in turn can be more educated citizens on making sound decisions with the data that's being developed through the program. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to some of our students, Alex Albright and Kevin Heald, who have been with the Barnesville program for several years. And we have our Riverwatch Forum coming up on March 18th at the University of Minnesota Crookston, where all the schools come together and share their information. And at that forum, actually, we'll have the Lake Winnipeg Research Consortium representative to come down to talk about the impacts on Lake Winnipeg stemming from the Red River and its tributaries. But so at that forum, the Barnesville students have given great presentations about their data and how it's being used in local decision making. So with that, I'll turn it over to Alex and Kevin to share some of their comments about the program.
Okay, thank you, Wayne. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Alec Albright. I'm a senior at Barnesville High School. I've been in the Riverwatch program for 3+ years. Basically, I guess I just want to share some of the benefits that I've personally experienced through the program. Like Wayne said, we go out, we sample the streams, we gather data, we put it in, you know, Excel spreadsheets, and we look at it and we see, you know, what are the problems here? But my experience has put me much past just the basic, you know, the science and stuff like that. It's brought me benefits in other areas of study. Like, I noticed that my problem-solving skills and, you know, gauging what the problem is and how to solve it, what evidence needs to be brought before to determine what the problem is, have really increased. And I guess a lot of that goes back to the Riverwatch program and going back to, you know, the scientific method of doing, of problem-solving. Another good benefit that I've received through my participation in the program is communication skills. This is a good example right here. I mean, if I was in this program, this is a great opportunity and I wouldn't be here. And I think that's really important for people in our communities, not only students, but other people, to get, you know, be part of what's going on with the laws and what's going on within the environment. So yeah, those are just the benefits I've received.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you for having me. My name is Kevin Heald. I'm also a senior at Barnesville High School. I've been in Riverwatch just as long as Alec has. And I just wanted to talk about some of the benefits that I've had. I've noticed that we went and taught fourth graders at the Yumcum Center over by Moorhead, and we taught them about the importance of water quality and that if you put stuff in the river, it'll eventually come back to you. So I have a river that goes right by my house. I live out in the country over by Barnesville. And if that were suddenly be polluted, all of our cattle in the area, my dog, cats, stuff like that, may not have as long of a life expectancy. So I just, that's all I really have today. Thank you.
Questions? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Sheila Carlson, and I'm their teacher. I'm privileged to be their teacher. And I feel lucky to be here today to speak on behalf of this bill. My role is that of a science teacher. That's my passion. And through the years, of course, it's important for us to share with our students basic scientific information. But beyond that, as future citizens, it's much more important that they have critical thinking skills and skills that are going to help them to make decisions in the future. And how do you make good decisions? You make good decisions based upon evidence. And how do you get evidence? Evidence is obtained by conducting experiments and tests where you set things up in a controlled way analyze the data that you've collected, interpret it, and then draw your conclusions. Usually, when we have done that with our sampling that has occurred each year since 2002, we have found more questions. We've found some answers, but we've also found more questions. And that has fueled the plans for the following year. As I said earlier, just a moment ago, we began our interest in the Riverwatch program in 2002. And since then, we have assessed many different streams in the area, and we're up to 20 now. We probably have more sampling sites than anybody else in the basin, and that's because we've taken those things on as projects. When we began our involvement in Riverwatch, I had been looking as a teacher for ways that our students could see how science really is, not just learning science facts out of a book or in a classroom, but how can you learn science for real? And science for real is applied science. Take what you've learned in the classroom and put it to use in the real world. Riverwatch was a perfect marriage. Riverwatch was our bridge. It was a bridge to understanding how the real world works by assessing and collecting data in the environment, bringing it back in, looking at it, interpreting it, and then sharing it or communicating it with other people. So Riverwatch for us became a way to incorporate applied science and extend the classroom, extend science beyond the classroom into the community. As a part of this process, we had to build some other partnerships. In order to make this work, we obtained guidance and help through the Red River Basin Monitoring Board, through Wayne. The Watershed District provided assistance. We even had, and the school district, of course, provided assistance to us, so we had a three-way partnership. In addition, we've had to go beyond that because there have been questions that have come up about the city water supply. There have been questions, and we've gone to the Department of Health. There have been questions that have come up about a variety of things, EPA, PCA, all kinds of organizations and government agencies have been contacted in order to help us answer questions. And that, I think, is real-world science. It's helping our students to understand the world in which they live by making informed decisions based on evidence that they've gathered using scientific method. And so with that in mind, we have stayed the course with Riverwatch in the school. And as a result, I would encourage that other schools do the same thing, and that's what we'd like to see. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good.
Mr. Chairman and members, that's really what this legislation is about, is to try to expand this type of program where you would use volunteers, include the schools and higher education institutions, and become kind of a tool to create some budding young scientists and engineers in the future. We also have, and I don't believe they want to testify, but Mr. Ron Harnack, who's the project coordinator, and also Charles Fritz, who's the director for the International Water Institute. And I know that in a tough budget year, this legislation, as you look at it, it asks for some revenues or some funding, which would be in the legislation says from the it would come from the Clean Water Fund, which, you know, I guess Senator Anderson probably knows better if there's going to be any there or not. But we felt that would be the best place that, you know, the work that's being done would be reflected. And I do appreciate, members, that you're taking some extra time to hear people who have traveled quite a distance to be here. So.
Did Mr. Fritz want to say anything? Thank you. Gold star. Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Powell, I'm curious, in your teaching, do you use the citizen monitoring material developed by the Pollution Control Agency?
And while we're on that question, Mr. Gokin or Mr. Harnack, too, could answer, what is the difference between what you do and the citizen monitoring program?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, all of our Riverwatch teams, the individual students, are enrolled in the Citizen Stream Monitoring Program, so our data goes into the MPCA Storet system. So it's included in that system.
And there's no difference?
We go beyond what the Citizen Stream Monitoring Program doesn't collect the extent of data that we collect. We do a monthly data collection, and we use technology. A standard set of equipment runs about $5,000. It's using some Sondi technologies where we're getting dissolved oxygen, turbidity, pH, temperatures, a variety of measurements that the Citizen Stream Monitoring Program does not collect. So it's a much more in-depth program than the Citizen Stream Monitoring Program. So we collect all of what they collect and then some.
Is PCA here?
They were here.
They were here for the previous bill. That's fine. Okay. First of all, congratulations. It's a wonderful program. You're really setting a model for the rest of the state. I've met with your program coordinators in person as well, and have been very impressed. I've had the opportunity to ask detailed questions, and I think you've really formed a model for the future. You're collecting information. You're collecting additional information that we don't normally do. Teaching our young people about science and an appreciation of our water and our environment. You're producing future biologists, which our country desperately needs. So I just hats off to everyone who's been involved with this program, and I can only speak for myself. I feel you're deserving of the support that this bill proposes and more. Senator Anderson, did you have your hand
up? Well, Mr. Chair, I agree with all of what you just said, and just want to echo that and to say that all of our clean water efforts that we intend to make with the new legacy dollars and just our clean water legacy program in general relies greatly on citizen volunteers and citizen monitoring and work done across communities all across the state. So this is exactly the kind of program that we do need to support in order to meet our clean water legacy goals. So thank you for the work you're doing.
Mr. Fritz, I saw you standing up. Did you have something you needed to add, or are you just stretching?
Stretching.
All right. Another gold star from Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, in the 1990s, Arne Carlson decided the Minnesota River was the dirtiest river in the state of Minnesota. And after you keep saying that over and over enough, it becomes a fact. But I was always wondered how he came to that conclusion. Because when I asked the question, well, if that's the dirtiest river, what's the second dirtiest river in the state of Minnesota? And nobody seemed to know. So what I've always suspected that maybe the Red River of the North was the second dirtiest. But I'm not sure. But because of the fine textured soil and it goes into suspension easily and it's hard for it to settle out and so forth, I suspected that it may be. And since you've been up there measuring water quality, do you know how the water quality in the Red River of the North compares to that of the Minnesota River? Or could the Red River be the dirtiest river in the state?
Minnesota really
never was the dirtiest.
One thing I know for sure is that our neighbors to the north are very interested in having a clean river.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman and Senator, my name is Chuck Fritz. I'm the director of the International Water Institute, and I'll be very brief. That's a tough question to answer. I can tell you that many reaches in the Red River North Basin and the tributaries are listed as impaired. And it would be unwise to compare water quality from one river basin to another because there are so many defining factors of what cause or what, you know, whether it's polluted or not polluted. But certainly the Red River has some issues to deal with, and those issues are very clear as we look north to the ecological endpoint of the river, which is, of course, Lake Winnipeg. And they do have some problems up there.
And one body of water might be contaminated primarily by phosphorus. Another might be Correct. Contaminated primarily by endocrine disruptors. So I think back in the 90s, that was kind of the dirty, it's the term of art, but now we've become more sophisticated and we use the term impaired. And then you have to ask additional questions. Right. How is it impaired? And then what is the best way to remedy that impairment? We just know that it's, whether it's endocrine disruptor or phosphorus, if there's too much, it's no good to swim or fish in, which is the standard we're using now. Other comments? The bill needs to go to finance. Is there anyone here who wants to testify in opposition to the bill? Motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that Senate File 880 be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Stumpf moves that Senate File 880 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you,
are we
Chairman.
Going over or are we going to do yours another?
This could be quick, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
The DNR's been waiting since the beginning of the meeting.
Mayor Parasol, thank you for your patience.
Can I take stats, too?
Of course.
Sure, but we will tell him that you
can. Yeah, tell him.
I swear.
You can't take one. I've had two kids.
Thank you. Harmony and peace at home.
That's right. That's all I can
do. Senate File 231, Senator Parasol.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File. Senate File 231 is a simple bill, and I went to Mr. Meyer first and then to Mr. Bogus from the department to ask about their suggestions, and they agreed that the content of it is exactly what they want to do anyway. And Mr. Bogus is here to talk about some of the... It is allowing a person who has been discharged from the military and has returned to Minnesota, allowing them to do, without having to go through the lottery, an either-sex deer permit, and that would be a permit with their license for deer. And if they have been served any time during the preceding 24 months in federal active service and have been discharged. And I think Mr. Bogus is probably the expert on this because he's been monitoring this in the department for a long time. So
Mr. Bogus, what's the difference between what we do now for these people and what this bill proposes?
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, Ed Bogus, Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife for the Department of Natural Resources. And currently there are several provisions in statute for active military who are either home on leave or for recently discharged veterans who've been discharged within the previous 24 months. And under Minnesota Statutes 97A465, Subdivision 1, we currently issue free deer licenses to military, active duty military who are home on leave. And when we issue those licenses, because that leave schedule isn't something they can always anticipate in advance, it is a license that's valid for deer of either sex. For the members who were discharged within the previous 24 months, they're also entitled to a free deer license, but also for preference in drawings, except for drawings for elk, moose, or prairie chickens, they're entitled to preference in the drawings. And that's created, I think, an unintended kind of consequence where if they don't get an application in time, and we do make those available online, they can fax them or email them to us, but if they're not aware of it or don't don't meet the deadline, which is the week of Labor Day, then in lottery areas of the state, which is where you have to go into a drawing to be able to take a deer of either sex, they could miss out on that opportunity. And we've actually heard from one of those people. I think the Senator Vickerman's committee has also heard from that person who was unaware of or unable to meet the deadline, wasn't drawn, and was restricted to bucks-only hunting in a lottery deer area, which these are primarily in southern and western Minnesota where we don't have as many deer. And if you're restricted to bucks-only hunting, your odds of getting a deer at all are greatly reduced. So there aren't a lot of people that fall into this category currently. We figured approximately 20 last year put into the drawing that had been recently discharged. And once they do that, they're automatically drawn. But we think it does make sense to do as Senator Paraso's bill would do, to just make it clear in statute that when they get that free deer license, it's valid for a deer of either sex. There's really no point in making them go through, for this particular drawing, making them go through that whole application process when they're given preference and are likely to be drawn anyway. And we're not talking about that many numbers. There's no fiscal impact to this because it's a free permit. They already get the free deer license, so the permit is really not something that we charge for anyway. So we just think this addresses something that hadn't been anticipated, and it makes sense.
Senator Dill?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bogus, when does a 24-month period begin or end? For example, if it's been almost 24 months since they were discharged, but the deer season is just beginning, are they still eligible?
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, it's currently they get the preference in the lottery if it's any time during the previous 24 months. If we do as Senate file, whichever number we're on right now, 231, then I think the 24 months would be at the time they're getting their license. There's a little bit of a window there in the fall, but those licenses become available in August. So if at the time they go to an agent to get their license, if they've served at any time in the previous 24 months, I believe that would be the answer. I'm not sure if we've done any rules that spell this out in more detail than that, but it's a good question because we would be changing that a little bit with this bill.
Senator Stump?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why do we say that they have to be discharged from active service? I mean, if somebody came, let's say, and had, you know, a month off during deer season, they would not be eligible?
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Stumpf and Mr. Knopf could correct me. I don't have the statutes in front of me, but I believe that situation is covered under subdivision one of the same statute that's not being amended in this bill, but that covers active service members that are stationed outside the state and that are home.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Knopf confirms that's true. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just commenting on your discussion of I think the way the bill is stated does address Senator Stump's concern about the time of application. If they're applying and shall issue if it's been any time at that point in paragraph B.
Right.
So. Any other questions? Discussion? I'm not seeing Senator Paraso. Should we lay this over for the Game and Fish bill?
Mr. Chairman, I would prefer that we pass. I know that Senator Vickerman would like to see it in his committee, so maybe we can pass it on.
Oh, does this need to go to veterans?
Yes, because it's veterans' part.
Okay.
So
right.
I would move then that Senate File 231 be recommended to pass on and send it to Senator Vickerman's committee.
Okay. And so let's make sure the Veterans Committee has a chance to take a look at it. But you don't have a problem with this moving forward in the Game and Fish bill?
Providing it shows up.
I don't see any
no
concern with it. I don't see any concern with it. Okay. Senator Parisow moves that Senate File 231 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Agricultural Veterans and Military Affairs. On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Seeing no more business, the meeting is adjourned, and the birdhouses are for you to keep.
Thank you.
Did you give me the birdhouse?
Thank you.
I'll take that. Good.
Flood plains. You see that?
Don't feed any deer with that.
What do I have to take with me now? None of these all belong to me. Oh, that's messing around with real patients. I thought I was shuffling my own.
Here. It's the wood in their birdhouses. Yeah, my nose has just been running.
Trying to keep it warm for you.
Good, thank you. Well, I might go downstairs in 2 seconds.
Pretty good, I think. How are you? Oh, okay. Thank you. You have to leave at 3?
Oh, fine. Okay, so you just got in on the committee.
Okay.
Well, thank you for coming over. Sorry we didn't get a chance to visit a little bit more.
Senator Anderson took out your public office.
We got these little birdhouses.
Oh, okay.
She saw the people in Scott was gone, so she's
exciting.
Let's see. Where is it?
Little
red book.
I thought I saw that there.
Which school are you from?
Yeah. David, your daddy?
Yeah.
Oh, you've enjoyed your time.
Let's see.
You have an active chapter?
5-3. I got to go to judiciary.
We can.
Well, I thank you. Thank you for coming down and spending a little time. I hope I can keep things going. I'm going to thank you.